Thanks for tuning in to the Journey Churches podcast. We hope you enjoy this message from Pastor Eric Reed. For more information, please check us out at tjclive.com.
We are beginning a new series this weekend, and that will last for the next 5 weekends, on the subject of trials and tribulations, afflictions, pain, and suffering in this life. Life is filled with pains and afflictions. Life is filled with struggles and with hurts. Life is filled with tribulation. Jesus says, in this life, there will be trouble, right? You can expect it. And the question that I want us to walk through in this series and that I want us to examine together, I would phrase and ask and say it like this. Is my faith in God so grounded, so rooted, so firm that when trials hit my life, I can stand? This is the question I want you to wrestle through. Is my faith in God so grounded, so rooted, so firm that when trials hit my life, I can stand? Or maybe I could ask it in this way. If you woke up tomorrow and your whole world was turned upside down, your world collapsed underneath you, could you stand? Do you have the faith to stand? Are you in such a place that you would endure and persevere? And here's the reality. The answer to this question is not going to be based on, do you have all the right beliefs? We just spent 11 weeks talking about how communing with God, abiding in the Lord, walking with the Lord is what we are called to do. Because simply believing a set of intellectual facts is not going to prepare you for when the bottom falls out. You have to be walking with him. You have to know him. And listen, I believe personally, this is a subject that the Church of Jesus, especially in America, has got to mature in. We have got to mature in our understanding of what it means to walk with God through struggles, through pain. This for me is not something I've read about and I'm coming to report on to you. This is something my family and I were forced to grapple with when we were 23. My wife and I were having our first child, our son, Caleb, and he was in the womb, and we learned that there were issues going on. We learned that he had a mass in his abdomen, and they weren't quite sure what it was, and tests revealed that it was a bad kidney, and a kidney that had cysts all over, and it was filling up with fluid. It was taking over his abdomen area. He ended up being born at 30 weeks, which was 10 weeks premature. He weighed about 2 pounds and 12 ounces after they drained all the fluid off of that bad kidney. And over the course of a 2-month period, he had several infections from this tube that was keeping that kidney drained. But the idea was that we were going to have surgery. We were going to have to get the kidney out. And we were told, we get the bad kidney out, you live a normal life. He can have one kidney and we'll be just like everybody else. And so at the end of the 2-month period, they made the decision, like, we need to go ahead and have the surgery. It's more of a risk to keep waiting. So we had the surgery. And after the surgery was over, we were told we got the bad kidney out, and the only thing we've got to wait for now is for him to pee and y'all go home. You know, y'all be discharged. And so I woke up the next morning fully expecting we were going to get discharged that afternoon or evening. So I left that morning to go to work. I was not yet in full-time ministry. I was doing an internship. I was working some side jobs. I was going to school. We were married. I now had a child we were about to bring home. So I was like, I got to go make some money. And so I was on my way to install a satellite. Yes, your pastor could install satellites. And I was about 30 minutes into my drive before I got the phone call. And Katrina was on the other line, panicked, and said, you've got to get back to the hospital. Something's wrong. Something's terribly wrong. The doctors are in here. I'm scared to death. I don't know what's going on. And I remember turning the truck around, and I remember driving back, and I was crying, and I was praying, and the only thing I could muster up was, God, this, you've got to fix this. Like, what's going on? I don't know what's going on, but you've got to fix it. You've got to do something. It's not supposed to be this way. It's not supposed to be this way. When I got back to the hospital, my mom was there with my wife, and within a few hours, we learned that a mistake had been made. Those awful words, we've made a mistake, were told to us. And his bad kidney was removed, but his good kidney had been removed with it on accident. And my 23-year-old self and the faith that I had in that time in my life was not ready for that. I did not have the faith that was ready for that kind of trial. There was not a foundation under my feet that could make sense of this. And I was undone. We as a family were undone, as you can imagine. And while you may gasp as you think about being in our circumstance, the reality is that each of you in your own unique ways have and do experience trials in your life that hurt, that are painful, that are bitter to endure. Every one of us here do. For some of you, it's around relationships. Maybe there is a broken relationship that has just devastated you. Maybe a divorce in the family. Maybe children that have gone astray, or children that have been sick, or maybe even children that have passed. Some of you, it's financial struggles and the pressure and the stress of that. And for others, it may be health problems. Some of you have lived your entire lives marked by pain. You don't really know much different. You've grown up always feeling like you were on the wrong side of how things were supposed to go. And then some of you were like me before that phone call. Your life has been relatively free of anything major and tragic. And yet, I want to say, it's coming. Whether it's next week or next month or next year or in 10 years, you can rest assured that the trials and the pains are coming. You cannot escape them. See, I had a theology, and we'll talk more about this next week, that kind of felt like I was exempt, right? I'm a Christian. I'm a pretty good dude. I love the Lord, right? He's supposed to protect me and keep me from all of that. And I wasn't ready for what was happening and what had come. Here's the lesson that I want us to have today, and I'm going to unpack it. Here's the statement I want you to hang to. God's providential dealings with us can be bitter to endure, but we must learn to trust him through them. God's providential dealings with us can be bitter to endure, but we must learn to trust him through them. What do I mean by providential dealings? What do I mean by that? Here's what I mean. I mean everything that happens in your life. Everything that happens in your life is from the Lord. God's providence, the providence of God, is God's active guiding in directing his creation, which includes us in it, towards his intended ends. God created the world, but he didn't just step back and watch it. He is active in the world. And the providence of God is his active guiding and governing of his creation towards an intended end. So the things that unfold in our lives, the things that take place in our lives, are the providence of God. And friends, sometimes those things are bitter providences, unpleasant providences, sour to the taste providences. And we've got to begin to understand that these things are from his hands. And the reason we buck against it, and the reason we struggle to understand and even adopt this idea, is because we think that God should be adopting our idea of kind of a pain-free life. Let me help you understand something. God cares more about and is more committed to our circumstances being sanctifying than them being smooth. God cares more about and is more committed to our holiness than our happiness, especially as we often define happiness. God cares more about and is more committed to the accomplishment of his will than the adopting of our wishes and our wants. God cares more about and he is more committed to the development of our character than the deepening of our comfort, especially as we often define comfort. And God cares more about and he is more committed to the fulfillment of his good and his wise plan than in the entertaining of our often hasty and tranquility-centered proposals to him. We would love for God to adopt our proposals. If it was our proposal, we'd all be on the beach, full bank accounts, healthy bodies, everything would just be roses, cupcakes, and rainbows. But God's good and wise plan is often very different than our proposals. This is an area where we have to mature. We have to grow and understand that God does bring these things into our lives. And if we ignore this or disbelieve it, it may be because our Christianity is more American than it is biblical. It may be because our worldview of the Christian faith is more American than it is biblical. I want you to think about the story in Daniel 1. I want you to think about the lives of these three particular Hebrew boys we're going to follow throughout this series. In 600 BC, Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians come into Israel. The Israel that had been spared and saved from greater nations, generation after generation after generation. The Israel who were God's chosen people. And what happened when Babylonians came in? What happened when Nebuchadnezzar marched his armies in? They won decisively. They conquered Israel. And not only did they conquer Israel, they flipped the world of every citizen in that country upside down. I want you to put yourself in the shoes of these three Hebrew boys. They are snatched from their homes and from their families. They are shipped out to another country to learn a different language, having been given new names, having to learn the literature and the culture of a new place. Everything they had known, gone. Everything turned upside down. See, we often read stories like this and we're just like, oh yeah, and you know, they shipped them off to Babylon. No, 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 put yourself in their shoes. These were young men who had plans for a future. They had dreams about what their life would be. They had desires for families. They knew all the stories of how their God had worked throughout their history. It wasn't supposed to be this way. I mean, they had grown up undoubtedly hearing all the stories of how God had moved for their nation, how God had rescued them out of the powerful hand of Egypt. How God had fed them in the wilderness. How God had showed signs and wonders to demonstrate, you're my people and I am your God and I will be there for you. I will give you victory over greater nations. I am there for you. You're my people. I'm your God. And all of a sudden, the Babylonians come in and smash them. It's not supposed to be that way, right? I want you to look at verse 2. A verse that we often ignore, which is the centerpiece of the story. After it says, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it, it says, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, the king of Israel, into his hands. Who did? Who gave the Babylonians victory? Say it out loud and don't be scared. The Lord. The Lord did. It doesn't say, and then Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians came in and Israel's defenses weren't fortified strong enough. It doesn't say, and they weren't trained well enough. They weren't equipped with the best gear to beat the Babylonians. It doesn't say, you know, they fell asleep during the watch and they didn't know the enemy armies were marching in. No, it says the Lord gave them into his hands. The Lord did. All of this is happening to these three young Hebrew teenagers by the hand and the design of God. In the providence of God, Israel is given into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. It is a bitter providence, indeed. Now listen, I'm gonna say something to you the TV preachers won't ever tell you. Though there are different means by which these things, these trials, and these afflictions will come into our life. There are different means. Listen, they're all from the hand of God. Ultimately, they're all from the hand of God. Now, we want to start bucking against that pretty quickly, and we say, no, hold on now, because, you know, are we putting God on the hook for wrongdoing? By no means. God cannot sin. God cannot do evil. God loves his covenant people. That's never in question. And yet he brings this bitter providence into their life. You find this all throughout scripture. He sovereignly ordains what happens. And before you dismiss this, I want us to work through here. Well, what are the options for how to think about this? Because it's not a matter of do they come. We're not in denial about trials and pain and affliction. So when you have to start grappling with how do we make sense of them, there's only a few options you have. Let me walk through those. Here's the one. There is no God. You could conclude there is no God. After all, I mean, hey, if there's pain and suffering and hurt, you know, why would God allow this? There must not be a God. And yet, while that may sound like an answer to the question, it actually, in fact, creates a bigger problem for the person that says it. Because see, here's the problem. If there is no God, and all we are just clumps of molecules and cells and atoms clashing against other clumps of molecules, cells, and atoms. If we're all matter clashing on matter, whether it's human skin clashing against buildings or cars or mountains or anthills, we're all matter clashing on matter, and there is no such thing in this universe as good or bad or evil or right or wrong or beauty or goodness or justice. These are all just illusions, because all that there is what is. And there is no such thing as saying there's pain, there's affliction. No, there's just what is. You can't say there's suffering. You can't say there's evil. There's only what is. So you don't get yourself off the hook by saying there is no God. In fact, if you say there is no God, you would also have to say there is no suffering. There's only what is. It's not right or wrong. It's not good or bad. So I can't call it something bad. So you don't do yourself any favors. In fact, the only reason why you say there is suffering or evil is because there's a God in the universe who gives us a standard of justice and righteousness and beauty and truth and goodness. And when you wipe away the reality of God, you wipe away any right to talk about pain or suffering. It's just strong eating the weak, friends. There's no good or bad in that. But there's a second option, because we don't often want to say that option. That doesn't make a lot of sense. So here's the second one. There is a God, but he's not responsible for our afflictions. This is what a lot of Christians often adopt. We say, okay, well, there is a God, but he's not responsible for our afflictions. And it sounds like a really good statement, because it sounds like we're keeping God off the hook, right? We're protecting God as if God needed us to protect him. As if God's like, boy, I'm glad you signed up to be my defense attorney. I don't know how it stood. I don't know how I'd have made it. No. Here's the issue with this problem, this view. To say there is a God, but he's not responsible for our afflictions, indicates one of two things. He's either handcuffed, and he's back here watching the world unfold like, oh, man, I wish I could help you guys. Oh, I wish I could involve myself, but man, that was bad. But I can't do anything. I'm up here, but I'm just watching the universe unfold. I'm not involved in anything. If you read the Bible, you learn quickly, that's not God. That's not the God of the Bible. So what do you do then? How do you make sense of the fact that afflictions happen and there's a God? Well, a lot of people would go, oh, well, he doesn't bring these things into our lives. He just lets them happen. Okay, well, does he let them happen because he's incapable of preventing it? Is he impotent? Does he not have the power to prevent it? Or does he not prevent it because he doesn't care? He's unloving. Is that the answer? And usually most people would say, no. And if I pressed you and said, okay, then why does he allow these things to happen? You're probably gonna start talking about some greater good that God has in mind. And yet I'm gonna ask you, if you're willing to say there's a greater good involved by God's passive involvement, why would you not think that there's a greater good in his active involvement? In fact, well, we'll get into this in a minute. Number three. There is a God, and he brings these things into our lives, but there is no reason. This is the worst option of all the options. It acknowledges there's a God. It acknowledges that he actually brings these things into our lives by his hands, and yet for no reason. They're arbitrary. It makes God maniacal and sinister and really cruel, like a kid with his magnifying glass, you know, on the anthill, you know, with the sun bearing down, right? There's no reason he allows these things. He just lets them happen. But that's, again, not a picture of the God of the Bible. So let me give you the fourth option. It's the most biblical option, and yet it's the hardest one. Here it is. There is a God, and he brings bitter providences into our lives. but he uses them for his purposes and the ultimate good of his people. This is the biblical option. There is a God who brings bitter providences into our lives, but he uses them for his purposes and the ultimate good of his people. This is a hard one because it acknowledges our trials and struggles are from the hands of God. But here's what it also does. It gives us hope that there is purpose in it. It's not arbitrary. There is, for the Christian, no senseless suffering. It doesn't exist. And we see this throughout Scripture affirmed. You see it in the story of Joseph, right? Joseph is sold into slavery, accused of adultery from a woman that he did not, you know, fall victim to her trap. He was then left in prison for a long period of time, even after he had helped the king and interpreted a dream. For a period of 20-something years, Joseph went through the ringer. And at the end of this time, he ends up being at the right hand of Pharaoh in Egypt. His brothers come, and he ends up sparing his family from famine, by the way, which was God's purpose in having him in those the whole time. But when his brothers are like, oh my goodness, he's going to kill us, we're done for, Joseph says this to them, what you intended for evil, God meant for good. In other words, the evil actions you committed against me and the trials that I have suffered for 20 plus years, God was always working for good. He was always moving towards an end goal. You see this in the life of Esther. You see it in the life of Job and others. The Bible tells us, Romans 8:28 tells us, in all things, the good things and the bad things, in all things, God is working for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. The caveat here is for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. Now, there's different means by which these trials come from the hands of God. There's different means by which they come. Let me give you four ways they come into our lives. First, they come through our own sin, oftentimes. Our own sin is often the means by which our own suffering comes. The damage we do by our own actions and our own choices. They come through other people's sins. Losing someone to a drunk driver is the perfect example of this. A family destroyed by a poor decision is an example of this. They come as a result of living in a broken and fallen world. Earthquakes, tsunamis, and tornadoes that wipe out towns and villages, cancer, all these things are the result of living in a sin-marred creation. So the brokenness of this world often brings the trials. And then fourthly, we have an enemy. They come directly from our enemy sometimes. But regardless of the means that bring them, we must understand that God ultimately, in some form, lets them come. How do we respond to that? Is that right? Job's wife, in the midst of their pain, said, curse God and die. Why would you even follow him? Why are you still hoping in God? Your life's in shambles. And this is what Job says to his wife. He says, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? Should we receive good from the hands of God and blessings from the hands of God, but not bitter providences from his hand? Should we not receive those as well? And here's what it says. It says, in all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. He did not misspeak when he said that. There was no sin in his mouth when he made that statement. The prophet Eli on the news from Samuel that his two sons were going to die. Samuel has a vision of the Lord. The Lord tells him Eli's sons are going to die. They've been wicked and disobedient. The next morning, Eli wakes up and says, hey, what did the Lord tell you? And Samuel's like, and he's like, tell me everything. And Samuel says, your sons are going to die. And Eli said this, it is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him. Is your theology there? It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good from his hands. There's bitter providences in this life, friends. So how do we navigate them? How do we navigate these things that God brings into our lives? I'm going to give you an answer this morning, and it may sound simple, but it is not simple at all. Trust him. You must trust the Lord. You must learn to trust him. And that does not come like flipping a light switch on, does it? See, you trust people who you know. You trust people whose character is sure. You trust people you're in relationship with. That's why we've been talking about this for the last 3 months. Communion with the Lord, walking with him is how you learn to trust him. You know his character. You know his faithfulness. You know he is true to himself. He cannot change. And in this, we learn to trust God. Listen to what the Proverbs say. Proverbs 3, 5 through 7. You've probably heard this. You've probably seen shirts and, you know, memes on Facebook and all. But listen, this is a hard statement to live out. But I want you to listen to it. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. With everything. And do not lean on your own understanding. Don't lean on your own understanding. Don't trust your wisdom. Don't trust your trying to connect the dots and make sense of it before you submit. Trust in the Lord. And don't lean on your own understanding. In all of your ways, acknowledge him. In your life, seek him. In your life, worship him. In your life, give glory and honor to him. And he will make straight your paths. He will direct the path that you go. He will write your story. Be not wise in your own eyes. Don't be wise in your own eyes. Don't try to play God. Instead, fear the Lord. Reverence the Lord. Honor the Lord and turn away from evil. This is what our lives are supposed to look like. We trust him. We trust him. We don't lean on our own understanding, because here's what happens. When you and I lean on our own understanding, when we try to be wise in our own eyes, we put God on the witness stand and we try to make him give an account for why he would do X, Y, or Z. Friends, God is not to be put on the dock. He doesn't give an account to us. We don't wag our finger and make him account for his ways. He is God, we are not. Instead, we trust him and we submit to him and we lean not on our own understanding. This is why we must be pursuing the Lord daily in his word, because there we find the character of God. And in prayer, because there we can lay out our request to him. We can make it known our need for help. This is why we walk in community with each other. It's why we preach GCs. Be in community, because when suffering comes, you don't want to suffer alone. We're going to have a whole week on that. We're not called to suffer alone. We need each other. But friends, you are called to trust him. Even when you don't know what's happening, when we can't trace his hand, we must trust his heart. When you can't trace the story he's writing, you have to trust the one who's writing it. William Cowper was a hymn writer who was a contemporary of John Newton in the 1700s. He wrote, "There is a fountain filled with blood," which is one of my favorite hymns. William Cowper's life was marked by pain and sorrow. He battled most of his adult life with severe depression, really dark places, suicidal thoughts. And John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace, would often minister to him and try to encourage him. But throughout his struggles, though, he was solid as a rock of understanding the sovereignty of God and trusting God through all that he was going through and experiencing. My favorite hymn of all time was the last one he ever wrote. It was about this very issue. It's called "God Moves in Mysterious Ways." And we don't ever sing this in churches. That changes next week. We're singing it next week. And the reason I don't think we sing it in churches is because it's uncomfortable in its truths. Listen to what he says. "God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Deep and unfathomable minds of never failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. These clouds you so much dread are big with mercy and shall break with blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind every frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. His purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. Blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his work in vain. God is his own interpreter, and he will make it plain. We have to trust him. Everything that comes from his hands, we can trust him with. These bitter providences, these frowning providences, he is working towards his ends and for our good, even when we don't know what they are.